Good morning, Swedish press readers. It's pleasant to have you with us. I have now the honor and pleasure of speaking to Johan Ernst Nilsson, an adventurer from Sweden. And Johan has been kind enough to join us here this morning and answer a few questions about his life and what he's doing and how he inspires people to do phenomenal and interesting things and how he's done a lot of interesting things himself. So, first of all, Johan, if I may ask you, what do you actually do?
Well, have you been talking to my parents again? So it's like, you know, sometimes it's really hard to explain. I hate sitting at dinner parties when people say, so what do you do? Well, it's kind of complicated. No, but I actually, what I do mostly, I travel around the world to give lectures. The base is turning the impossible into possible. The base has been adventure travels since like 20 years. I've done 32 expeditions. I've been to 142 countries. So meeting a lot of cultures, solving problems, and dealing with obstacles where like the impossible has to be turned possible. So that's kind of like the base of it. Then you have a lot of like branches that goes out, which is photography, film producing, books, lectures, personal private coaching. So it's a lot of like, you know, a lot of branches that goes up, but the core business is motivational speaker, lectures, and exploration.
Interesting, very interesting, and very broad. And then, so how and why did you get started with this?
When I was 15 years old, I was watching television. Somebody was playing the piano, and I asked my mother, "Who is that?" "Well, his name is Elton John. He plays the piano." I said, "That sounds fantastic. I want to learn to play like Elton John." She said, "Well, it is kind of tricky, but it's not impossible," she said. "I mean, you have to stay focused, you have to stay motivated, and find your motivation, but most of all, you have to practice." So I made a bet with myself. Within 3 years, somebody would pay me to play the piano. So 3 years later, I was working as a concert pianist. I played all over Europe playing the piano when I was 18, 19 years old. And I worked for like 3-4 years working in bars, restaurants, all over, like, you know, mostly in the south of France, playing the piano. Then one day I was working at the Grand Hotel in Stockholm playing the piano, and my friend said, we were talking about this motivation strategy, like how you can like turn impossible into possible. And they said, well, you happen to have an ear for music, but can't just put this in a different context. You can't just take like, you know, something and then just with motivation and focusing just reach it. I said, well, I can actually do whatever I want to. I mean, I can become a surgeon or an MD or whatever I want to with this strategy. It's just that I don't feel like it. Well, I mean, just take something impossible, like, you know, like something physical. You were always the worst in the soccer team in high school. You were always the worst, and you were always like had the lowest grade in gymnastics. So let's take something physical. So we made a bet. I would like the next week quit my job and get a bicycle and bike to the Sahara in Africa.
How old were you then? How old were you then?
Well, this was 94.
So you were what?
So I'm 43 now, so that makes me 24.
Okay.
So I quit my job. I went up to my manager, said I would like to quit because I'm biking from Grand Hotel to the Sahara in Africa. He said, you can't quit, you're fired. It's the most stupid thing I ever heard in my entire life. So that was much easier than I didn't have a job. So I got my bike and I got my tent and I started biking to the Sahara. I threw up the first day. It was the worst thing I ever done in my life. The first week I wanted to give up. Would I give up? Never. Did I think about it? Yes. I thought, like, you know, what am I doing and why am I doing this? Well, you see, my whole life, you have this, like, it's a metaphor, but I have in my lecture a picture of this wooden horse that you like jump over that you have in gymnastics. So I was hiding behind that one because every time they were going to pick out people for like the football team, I was hiding behind that one because in that way I didn't have to prove anything.
Right.
I just have to hide. So which means that this was the first time I walked outside my comfort zone. I stepped on the other side of this wooden horse, so to say, to actually try to change something, move outside the comfort zone. I might fail, I might lose, but I might also win. But the important thing, I will never find out if I like never try. So this trip, like, you know, was like the first time I did something that was really like, I mean, different from like my early life. So then I started to find out that it was actually possible to do the impossible. 52 days later, I reached Africa and I've learned how to play the piano. Interesting. Can I just apply this on different things? So I started more and more to work with, like, I was very curious. I published a book with poetry, 365 poems. I opened up a nightclub. I went to fashion design school. I like to make, like, you know, my own collection. I tried all different kind of things to see if the motivation strategy would work in different kind of, like, you know, ways. So I got back to exploration again, and I started to travel the world. And today, as I said earlier, I've been to 142 countries. So I've been traveling all over the world. I think it was Socrates who said, the more I learn, the more I understand that I don't understand it. I don't know anything at all.
Right,
and
right.
The more I travel around the world, the more I understand I haven't seen anything yet. I mean, 20 years ago, when I kayaked, when I biked to Africa, I thought, like, now I've seen the world. Today, 20 years later, I know that I haven't seen anything yet. Though I've been to Antarctica, North Pole, South Pole, Everest, and, like, you know, to the major cities in the world, still, I feel like it's so many things that I want to see in the world. I'm a very curious guy. I like always to, like, look if there's a hill, if there's a corner, I would love just to go around the corner and see what's on the other side.
Okay. So tell us a little bit more about this motivation strategy. I mean, it sounds easy enough. You tell yourself to do something, and I think many other people tell themselves to do something, but they might not get there. I mean, what have you figured out, and what is it perhaps then that works for you that might not work for others?
Well, first of all, I have something that I call my personal Everest, which is Everest is a metaphor for reaching your own personal dreams in life. And to me, it has been the tricky part is not to reach my goal. The tricky part is to find out what is my goal, because you have a lot of, like, you know, people. I want to talk about dreams and goals a little bit here, because, you know, that actually goes into my strategy, because people have a lot of, like, you know, goals. They say, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to get a house in Spain, I want to, like, go on vacation, I want to get a dog, I want to get married, whatever.
Right.
You have goals that you can touch. Mm-hmm. But dreams, like becoming an astronaut, or, like, you know, creating an industry, or change the world in the non-profit organizations, whatever it is, it's too far away. People are afraid of dreams. Mm-hmm. So when I work, like, with my personal Everest, the most important thing, first of all, is to find out what is my dream, what is my actual dream that I want to reach. And then by goals, by reaching small goals along the way, you will reach that dream. But the most important thing is that, first of all, to find out what it is. And when I've been talking all around the world, I noticed that that's actually the first and most important thing we have to deal with. What exactly is our dreams?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, a lot of people say, I would love to do this and that. I have so many things that I want to do. Yeah, but what is it that you want to do the most? What is most important for you to do right now or start preparing for the future? And people say, well, I don't really know. Well, in that case, that is your personal Everest. Your personal Everest is to find out what is my personal Everest.
Right,
so,
right.
So once you actually find out what is my goal, what is my dream, and I really want to get there, then comes the structure. And you have to see yourself win before you start. You have to see yourself reaching the summit. Every time I go to a mountain, I look at the summit and I visualize myself reaching the summit. Then it's just, like, you know, structure and organization to really get to the summit. But the most important thing is to actually visualize yourself. First of all, find out what is the mountain, what is my personal Everest, and then see yourself. If you want to get a job, see yourself signing the contract inside the room with the CEO. If you want to date the beautiful girl in the bar, see yourself walking up to her and say, do you want to have a drink? Visualize yourself doing what you might and other people might say would be impossible. So, to me, it's interesting how the impossible becomes possible through doing it. Because if you look back in time, if you see the Berlin Wall, if you see apartheid, if you see penicillin, if you see, like, you know, cures all kind of diseases and things, people or walking on the moon or running faster than 10 seconds or 100 meters, why even try? Mm. Because it's impossible. And then one day somebody changes everything and does it. Tears down the wall, runs faster than 10 seconds, and the impossible becomes possible by doing it.
Right.
So
right.
Somebody has changed everything one day. So I never say things are impossible. I always say that I don't know how to do it.
At this point.
So like in my lectures, I show this brick wall and I say, can I walk through this brick wall? And people say, no, it's made of brick. You cannot walk through that wall. And my answer would be, I don't know how to do it. But that doesn't mean it's impossible. It's just that in my lifetime, I might never be able to do that. But in 1 million years, people might be able to, like, you know, put themselves into molecules, whatever, and on the other side, back again. I have no idea. And you might never be able to do it. But the interesting part is that you can never say it's impossible because you don't know what happens in the future. So which means that I don't know how to do that yet. So it's a lot of, like, you know, in the inspiration and the motivational speeches, it's a lot about how you see things, like the angle. Mm-hmm. Like, if you see things impossible, they will be and they will stay impossible. If you will see that, well, I don't know how to do it, that opens up a door. It opens up a door saying that I might not know how to do that yet, but that doesn't mean that somebody else will do that in the future, or I might learn how to do it.
Right, right, right. So you've now done 32 expeditions, and you've done all these amazing wacko things, and then it seems to me that you're getting more and more into inspiring other people. Now, when did that become important, and what do you hope to do with that?
Well, first, let me take the first question first. When it all happened, I think that, I mean, starting with, like, you know, the lowest grade in gymnastics, it was very important to me to prove to me and to my friends and to everybody that, like, you know, I really can do something, because I couldn't. You know, when I grew up, I was, like, you know, like the joke in my class, like, you know, yeah, you were going to play football. Yeah, very funny. You know, so to me, it was very important the first few years to actually show I needed that. You know, I just needed to, like, put my foot down, say, like, listen, guys, I can actually do something. And then, like, you know, after, like, hundreds of interviews and these kind of things, like, you know, after, like, 5, 6, 7 years of like, traveling and doing adventures and mountains all over the world, I started to get tired and also a little bit, like, you know, why am I just talking about myself and my climbs? Where is this leading? Mm-hmm. I just got tired of these discussions. So it was more and more, I started to more and more get into, yes, I did this, but you know what? You can also climb your own mountain. Everest.
Right,
so I started more and more to work with that. So I started, first of all, to travel around schools all over Sweden and also churches where I gave free lectures. And I'm not a Christian person. It's just that it just happened to be that I thought that age of like kids is a very fragile age, because that was the age when I really needed motivation. And there's no motivation in Swedish schools, not in the US or Canada, I mean, either. So people really need inspiration. Mm. So I started to travel around, and I got this this medal from the Swedish Church, and I got really happy, and I understood that maybe this is important. So I started more and more to work with charity. I became ambassador for an organization named Min Stora Dag, translated My Great Day.
Right.
It's kind of a Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Yeah,
we have sick kids to fulfill and find their dreams. So I started to work with them, and I started to work as also for Mentor, a Swedish organization working for schools. So I became ambassador for their organization run by the Swedish Queen. So I started more and more to work 50% of my time working with inspiration, motivation for companies, but also non-profit for organizations and for schools and hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
So it all started actually when I really turned around in my thoughts. I thought, like, hey, it's not really important to just talk about me. I want to talk about what can I share? Like, what kind of memories, what kind of, like, obstacles have I actually climbed over, and where did that, like, you know, take me? So I think that around the end of the 90s, that was, like, you know, the turning point. I've been doing, like, 6, 7 years of, like, you know, interviews and then traveling all over the world with lectures and things. So I felt like, listen, this is not taking me anywhere. I want to, like, you know, help other people. So now I'm doing that more than 50%. I hope at the end of the day I will do that 100%. So that's kind of like how it all started and how it all changed.
Right.
And now, then the next question was...
What do you hope to do for others? Yeah, I mean, how do you actually... I mean, and even is it possible to inspire somebody else? I mean, is inspire something comes from inside, or is inspiring something that can come from something you get from somebody else?
Well, first of all, I think that the best motivation and inspiration is actually based on things people already know. Mm-hmm. For example, people need storytelling, people need examples, people need a structure to reach certain like levels, or if they want to quit smoking or become happier or whatever they want to do, is that they already know that. I mean, there's nothing like that I talk about, or Deepak Chopra, whoever, that is not like, I mean, everything is very, very clear. It's not like, you know, like a flash coming out of the blue sky. It's just common sense. It's just that I've been through situations where I have to solve problems in a different way. So I have two new books now. One is called The Answer is Yes. And that book is based on 20 expeditions, 20 mm-hmm. problems, 20 solutions by thinking differently. So let me give you an example. I was kayaking from Stockholm to Africa in 96. And I'm taking the locks, 400 locks, from Lübeck in Germany down to Marseille in France. And then in one part of Germany, they closed the lock system. And I asked this old man, so how can I kayak through this part of Germany? They said, well, it's not possible. Well, I said, everything's possible. Yeah, but there's no water. You cannot kayak and the lock is closed. Yeah, but there must be one way. No, it's impossible. Let's just for a second pretend that it would be possible. I said, well, I can't, it's impossible. Let's just do some Peter Pan. Just make believe. Think happy thoughts. You know, make believe that it would be possible.
Yeah.
Then what would you do? Well, he said, if it would be possible, which is not, but if it would be possible, I guess I would have chosen the sewer system under the city. So I go up the fire department, open up the gates, down with the kayak, in the sewer systems, in the tunnels, and I kayaked 3 kilometers under the city, got out on the other side. It didn't look too funny. And then this old man is standing there looking at me and said, are you crazy? And I'm like, why? I mean, I told you it's impossible. Yeah, but you see, it was possible. Yeah, if you think like that. Exactly.
Yeah, if you think like that.
So if you think differently, I mean, all of the biggest things that ever happened in, like you know, in the history of mankind has always happened because somebody was thinking outside the box and a little bit differently. Right. So that book is based on that, and I hope to change with my lectures and my books by telling the storytelling around situations where I had to solve problems that other people can think. Well, wait a minute. I read this book with Johan Ernst Nilsson, and he really, like, he took the sewer system under. Maybe there's another way I can look at this problem. Maybe I can find another solution to this problem. So that's kind of like, you know, what I hope for.
Right. Now, do you find that you go to all these different countries and you meet people from all sorts of different cultures? Is there a common theme in terms of what inspires them, or is it very different depending on in what country you are?
It is very different depending on the culture. For example, let me put it this way. In Sweden, we don't really believe that we can do anything at all. We know where the goal is. We're not so confused. We're very focused in terms of, we know that one day we would like to do this and that, but we're too shy and we don't have the confidence to actually go for it. Because you say like, oh, who am I to do that? You know, I mean, these guys, they're like, you know, I had them on like, you know, poster on my wall when I was a kid. I cannot be that guy. So we have the structure, we know where we're aiming, but we're too shy and we are like, we don't believe in ourselves to reach it.
Uh-huh.
In the US, on the other hand, they do have the confidence and they do have everything around it, but they have not really like, you know, they don't really know where to go. They just run everywhere and they just so like, you know, if they believe in, they can do anything. But, you know, yeah, but just focus on one thing. So if you would take Sweden and for example, Silicon Valley, if you can take the goals that we have in Sweden with confidence you have in Silicon Valley, maybe you can put that together. So I mean, that's a big difference. In Japan, on the other hand, you never talk about failing. You never talk about Thailand is like the same. So you cannot really talk about failing or doing mistakes because they say that we never do that. So when I give lectures in that part of the world, like a lot of parts, like in Asia or in China, they're very uncomfortable with discussing failures. And I ask people in the audience, can you tell me the biggest failure you ever done and what did you learn from it? It's just quiet. 1,000 people are just sitting there looking at each other. Right. While in the US, people say, I don't know me, I'm next, I want to talk about my failures.
Yeah.
No, because that's like, you know, it's okay because you can never reach anywhere in life without taking some kind of risk. But on the other hand, in Asia, people say that, oh, no, I never do any mistakes because I'm so structured. And then I tell them, well, if you never do any mistakes, you never push your limits. Because by pushing your limits, you will know, bang, there's a wall. Okay, so that's either I have to go back and learn how to climb the wall or I have to take another way around. But at least, you know, that was the end.
Right,
so which
right.
means that it's different cultures all over the world. So you have to a little bit try to angle your lecture a little bit depending on what culture you speak to.
Right. So you mentioned Swedishness, and you're saying that Swedes are too shy or not confident enough. Now, you are Swedish, and you have Swedish background, and I guess many Swedish qualities. So is there anything in what you're doing that has been improved by the fact that you are Swedish? I mean, what Swedish qualities are helping you to do what you're doing?
I think that what we have in Sweden is something that is very valuable, actually. It's we have the value that we have, like the moral, the value, and the ethics behind, mm-hmm. In a lot of countries, people will say, why don't you do that? Yeah, but then the other guy say, yeah, but that's not good to do. Yeah, but I have a lawyer we can get around with. So in Sweden, people say, well, that's not good to do. Yeah, but I can get away with it. I have somebody at a law firm that can help me. Yeah, but in Sweden, say, yeah, but that's not correct.
Mm-hmm.
In Sweden, we will go, we find something, money, and on the street, we pick it up and say, who's this? In a lot of countries, people would not do that. Because in Sweden, we say, I can't take this guy's money because it's not mine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, in a way, we are very, very sweet people in Sweden. We like to, help. We are very, the moral is very high.
Yeah.
And if you, for example, my great-grandfather, he was when he did business, he shook somebody's hand. And that was that was signing the deal.
Right,
because
right.
if he shook somebody's hand, you cannot really change that. Because that was that was his hand.
Mm-hmm.
That meant more than any lawyers in the world. So, which means that kind of philosophy is something that we have in Sweden that I like a lot.
Is that helping you in your work? I mean, does your Swedish background help you in becoming a better explorer? Or help you in inspiring people or in getting lectures?
Well, I think it's the same values. I think that, knowing what's wrong or right and trying to be as correct as possible, trying to mean well, but also the values of knowing the right thing. For example, if you are on a mountain and somebody's lying there, maybe dying or whatever, you have the moral and the value comes in like a split of a second. You have one guy from one country say that, let's leave the guy, because we don't know him. Maybe the Swedish guy will say, well, that's not correct. We have to help him. So, now I'm just taking the extremes. But
mm-hmm.
I'm saying that in all, the values we have in Sweden is the moral and the ethics are so much higher than many other countries that I've been to.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
I think that has helped me a lot.
Excellent. Good. Because maybe as the Swedish press, we always want to see how can we take the benefit of Sweden when we're spreading things out, or when we're spreading news to the world, and what is our Swedish strength in when we do this thing. So it's important to hear that you feel that even when you go around the world, your Swedishness is helpful and beneficial in what you're doing.
Oh, it is totally, and also I also think that we are in Sweden. We have, for example, for some reason, there's a big difference also between Swedes that have traveled a lot and Swedes that are still living in Sweden. I guess it's the same all over the world. But I realize that a Swedish guy that's been to, like, for example, US a lot or other countries, they have the values and the moral of, like, you know, like the base of Sweden, but they have the entrepreneurship and the visions that they have in the US. So I'm thinking, like, you know, combining these two is really interesting from both parts. I mean, if US can, like, you know, work more with us, and we can work more with them, because yeah, I think a collaboration can be interesting. But I really think that we really have a background in many generations back, and maybe that's because we have so many generations back. You don't have that in US. It's more survival. It's more like, you know, I mean, the country is a couple of hundred years old, so which means that it's not the same kind of thinking. It's more like, you know, let's go for it, you know, which is fantastic. But I also like the, like, you know, the background we have in Sweden since, like, thousands of years back. We learned, like, you know, like, not to do this, not to do that.
Right. So let's shift gears a little bit. In all the explorations you do you ever have fear? And what does fear do for you? Is it motivational, or is it sort of stopping you? Or what I mean, what is there, and does it come through to you in all these expeditions?
Fear is a safety net. Safe is something that we, in generations and generations and millions of years, have actually developed. Because it, like, if you go up to a snake and you're afraid of the snake, it means that in evolution we've learned that the snake is dangerous. So you should listen to that. Then you can go back, you can learn what kind of snake is that, is it dangerous? So you can learn how to take the snake by its tail, whatever. But still, you move back. And that is fear, which is good. So what I've learned about fear is that fear is good when approaching something or when starting to plan something. Like, for example, if I'm going to jump from a building with a parachute, okay, the fear is of me planning to go up, put on the parachute, and then jumping, and will I make it or not? That is the fear. So then we sit down, we take the fear, put it in one box. Okay. The next box is that, how do we take that fear and how do we overcome that fear? Mm-hmm. How do we structure that fear so we can actually use it? So then we have two boxes. The third box will actually be the two combined, which means that once you go up on the roof, and once you jump, you take away the fear. Because I don't need the fear. The fear is in the structure and in the planning to do the jump. While I'm jumping, the fear is gone. I cannot have the fear. So which means that when I do a climb of Mount Everest, the fear is never on the mountain. The fear is actually planning the things that is unplannable. I mean, how do you plan for things that, I mean, you cannot really believe is going to happen? So I mean, those things are fear. One guy at the lecture once said, listen, I want to join you one of your expeditions. Okay, so what is your qualifications? Well, I'm not afraid of anything. Well, then I don't want you on my team, I said. I want people who are scared. I want people who have fear, but who have fear for what they are about to do, not while you do it. So I think that what I've learned during the years, if I'm in a situation now where I really get, like, scared, I've learned to take away the fear and just, like, you know, just execute. While then I can be afraid afterwards. Like, for example, let's just take this lecture that I did now for, like, almost 2,000 people for Facebook 2 days ago. I mean, the fear was like, okay, it's going to be Mark Zuckerberg, he's going to be the founder of Instagram, the president of Nike, it's going to be, like, you know, 2,000 people, like, the most important people in the Silicon Valley in the world, sitting in front of me. The fear was, how am I going to do this lecture in 45 minutes? What am I going to talk about? How am I going to structure it? And then when I structure it, I took away the fear. I just went up and I gave everything on the stage, because the fear was gone. The fear was in the planning. The fear was not on stage.
Mm. So it sounds to me that you actually have the ability to pull up the fear before it happens. So you're using the fear that could happen in the situation to plan and structure things.
Well, I mean, to tame would be a strong word, but I'm attempting. I'm trying, and I'm trying as I found a technique that I use. I mean, the mindset of not being afraid while jumping from that building or going up on that stage. That fear, I've learned to take away that fear, but I'm still not there. I still have a couple of thousand years to go in practicing before getting everything away. But I still have the technology in my head, the structure of that is a system that I have, that is the method I have to work on.
Right. But when you're out kayaking and when you were out, I think I saw somewhere you're out on the ice and there's water in front of you, or you fall into the water. I mean, has that also been pre-planned in sort of a previous thinking through this could happen, and therefore when it actually happens, you don't need to be fearful?
Well, one of the most important skills you need as an explorer is actually being flexible. Which means that you have to adapt the whole time. You can plan to a certain degree, but you cannot plan for everything. So when falling through the ice, yes, I have planned that I might fall through the ice. So I planned what would happen. I haven't really planned how to get up through the ice. I mean, in terms of, I know how to do it, but when it happens so fast, so you get shocked. But then you have to, like, you know, think after 1 second, okay? So I've trained for this before, so how am I going to do this? How am I going to, get up? So, in one way, I have planned for most of it, but what I really try to plan now, what I really, my biggest fear now is the things that I cannot foresee. Mm-hmm. For example, when I was kayaking from Stockholm to Africa, I had a shark biting in the rudder in the end of my kayak. And I had a list of things that might happen while kayaking from Stockholm to Africa that was not on the list.
Right, right.
So, which means that how do you plan for something that you cannot plan for? Well, you have to plan for that in one way, to be flexible when it happens. Mm. So, for example, if I'm sitting here now and I see a meteorite coming from the sky, I mean, I cannot really do anything about it. What I can do is that I can think really fast of, how do I think fast and what do I do? Do I run out of the room or do I jump out of a window, whatever? I mean, it's just like the question is based on how do I think flexible and how do I act directly? So which means that I cannot plan for everything. I cannot plan for a meteorite coming from the sky right to me for the moment. So which means there's a lot of things I cannot plan, but I can plan how to think flexible when things happen.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's interesting that it's all in the planning from what I'm hearing. A lot of sort of fear avoidance is in the planning.
Well, yes, but yes and no, because, some things you cannot plan. So,
right.
So some things are based on not planning at all, just like try to deal with them, with the problems. But I always say in my lectures also that you have to learn from the past, plan for the future, but live in the present. So which means that all the mistakes, everything that happened back, like 43 years back in time, that's knowledge. That's I've learned, in time things. And I try to sit down and look at my mistakes and things that I've done. And how can I adapt? How can I learn from that? That's one thing. That's the past. The future is that how can I take the past into the future? How can I learn from the past, plan for the future, and take the knowledge from the past and put it into the future, but still never forget to live in the present, to live in the now, to live in the 100%, be present. So which means that by standing in the middle, I can look back, I can look front, and I can have a balance between planning for the future and learn from the past.
Right. Good. So kind of on that note, then, if you look far into the future, and when you sort of intend to slow down, whatever slow down means and when that is, what do you want to have left behind? I mean, how do you want the world to remember Johan sometime in the future? Well, when do you feel that you've reached sort of whatever that bigger goal is?
The only only failure we can do in our lives is to not to try at all. I mean, I think that when I want to look back, I want to say that I've done a lot of mistakes. I've done a lot of things that I should have done differently, but I don't regret anything. Because I want to try things, I want to see things, I want to... I mean, that's from my point of view. Mm-hmm. From like the other point of view, I want to leave behind me strategies and motivation, like, you know, like thinking that I can leave, I mean, from my 20 years of exploration, leaving some kind of, as you call it, legacy of stories that might be something people take with them and say, like, you know, in 200 years, yeah, but you remember that story, this guy who did this and that, you know, and he was going and there was this locker system with locks and he actually went through the sewers. You remember that guy? Yeah, I remember. I read in a book, like, you know, my great father had that book. Yeah, but, you know, that was all about thinking differently. So let's just think about this project in a different way. Then I have reached somewhere. But also I think that it's... I think it's a lot about not really, I mean, me. It's about us. I think that if we can think more that like strangers or friends you don't know. I mean, you know, when I travel the world, I meet so many cultures, and I see that we are so different, but we are still. I mean, the value is still the same. Mm-hmm. Me and a cannibal tribe, like, you know, chief in some jungle, it's very different. Our worlds are so different, but we are worth the same. So we have the same value. It's like I see people all over the world, and I see that really, that, you know, that a kid or an old man, whatever, we have the same value. It's hard to say what I want to leave behind, but I think my thoughts and my ideas is something I want to leave behind.
Mm-hmm. So maybe on a closing note then, what is the, I mean, you've done a number of adventures. I don't know if you can pick one today that is your greatest so far, if there is a greatest so far, and then maybe is there an ultimate one that you're still planning that you want to do?
First of all, so what is exploration? Exploration, what people say that, well, exploration, that's a guy traveling from one side to the other, or reaching a summit, or reaching the South Pole, whatever, that's exploration. Yeah, but exploration is also an inner journey where you actually reach your own limits and you expand your own comfort zone. So, I mean, all these explorers that read about, like Amundsen, Scott, Nansen, Hillary, all these guys, well, they did geographical, Columbus, Vasco da Gama, Sven Hedin, I mean, they all did geographical journeys, but what they left behind was something else. The exploration was an inner journey showing that the impossible is made possible through doing it. Mm. And it's expanding culture, expanding, and also like getting the world a smaller place by, like, you know, starting to understand each other's languages. So exploration for me is something that has been really, really important to understand, that it's not a geographical journey, it's an inner state of mind as how we see exploration. So for me, what was the question again?
One was the greatest one you've done so far, and if there's an ultimate one that you're still planning to do.
Yeah, well, so the biggest exploration I do now is an inner journey. It's not a geographical exploration. It's more of, like, you know, try to understand more cultures, peoples, and why, for example, Japan, Sweden, and the US are so different in the way they think about motivation and strategies, but still we are the same kind of people on this planet. But still, we are so different. How can we learn from each other? So the exploration to me is more of an inner journey now. Mm-hmm. But if you would take if I would have to answer the question regarding any, like, you know, coming adventure, so I'm helping a guy next month in a wheelchair to climb the highest mountain in Sweden, Kebnekaise, in his wheelchair. That's going to be a fantastic adventure. I'm swimming the English Channel from France to England. It's going to be an interesting adventure also.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. It's just 17 hours of swimming, but it's like, you know, 1 year of planning. So more these kind of things. I don't want to be away for 18 months again. I don't want to be like my last adventure was 525 days. I don't want to be away that long. I want to have a family. I want to settle down more. So I think that in the future, it will be like shorter expeditions, but more of like, you know, more with books and more with films, these kind of things. The ultimate adventure, I mean, like of all the things that I've done, must have been like, you know, the last journey with the North Pole and the South Pole, everything. But my biggest experience must have been standing on the summit of Mount Everest, to actually stand on the top of the world and knowing that I had the lowest grade in gymnastics, and then I'm on the highest point of the planet. And that was kind of, for me, a very important personal state of mind, you know.
Yeah, well, that sounds great. So starting with the lowest grade in gymnastics and reaching the highest point. That's how far motivation can take you. I think that's wonderful. Yuan, we thank you very, very much for your time. Wish you all the very best in the future exploration, both the inner exploration and the outer explorations that you will be doing.